Today, the first session today is going to be Comrade Janey Percy Smith talking on the subjects of what socialists can learn from feminist ideas. And she's going to talk for 30 to 40 minutes, after which there'll be time for questions and contributions from the audience. So,
thank you, Comrade. As you just heard, the question that I'm going to be looking at is what socialists can learn from feminists. And I think this is quite an important question, if for no other reason that feminist ideas are quite persuasive to many women. And we need to ask ourselves the question, why is this the case? And I think secondly, we need to take on board some of the issues that feminism raises. So what I want to do in the talk this afternoon is to show that there are important lessons that we can learn from both feminist analysis and practice, but also to show that not all of those lessons are positive lessons, that we can also learn important lessons from the shortcomings of feminism. So that's broadly how I want to structure the talk, is to look at both positive lessons and negative lessons, and to look at them in relation to three areas. A short introduction relating to ideas. Secondly, to look at the implication of some feminist ideas for our propaganda. And thirdly, to look at the implications of feminist ideas for women's role within the Socialist Party. Now, I'm going to look very briefly at feminist ideas and what we can learn from them to start with, but I want to stress that I'm not going to go into great detail about feminist ideas. I don't think it's particularly useful at this sort of occasion. I want to try to draw very practical lessons that we can learn as socialists from feminist ideas. So I apologise in advance for the very simplistic overview that I'm going to give of feminist ideas. But in talking about feminist ideas, I think the most important thing to remember is that there is no single body of feminist ideas. There is, in fact, several different sets of ideas that could be broadly termed feminist. And in many respects, they contradict each other, which I think is perhaps an indication of the confusion that exists within the body of people who would define themselves as feminists. So what I want to look at is very briefly to focus on some feminist ideas in relation to three broad areas. Work, including both work outside the home and work within the home. Secondly, to look at ideas from feminism relating to sexuality and images of women. And thirdly, to look at some feminist ideas about sex role stereotyping. So to look at the whole area of women and work first, I think that feminists have very usefully highlighted the extent to which women are concentrated within capitalist society in, generally speaking, low-paid, unskilled work, and they have also looked at the ways in which women are used as a reserve army of labour, aspects that Karima looked at quite extensively yesterday, so I don't want to spend too much time looking at that. But I think it is worth emphasising that women's role is not static within capitalism. It does change. So what is accepted as normal, acceptable female behaviour shifts according to what else is going on in society. So when labour is short, women are encouraged to go out to work. When there is a surplus of labour, then they're encouraged to go back into the home. So to start off from a viewpoint that says that capitalism entails women adopting a primarily domestic role is not always true. The situation is dynamic, it changes. If you look at different points in history, then different aspects of women's role is emphasised. The second thing is that feminists have also focused on the fact that there is a sexual division of labour within the home, such that women in general take on the major responsibility for domestic work. Again, Karima looked at the way women work a double shift, that they work outside the home for wages, they work inside the home without wages, doing things like childcare, cooking, cleaning, washing, and so on. And feminists, I think, have also drawn attention to the way in which that domestic work is in general undervalued, the I'm only a housewife syndrome. So that not only is housework and childcare not highly valued, perhaps because it hasn't got a wage, a price attached to it, but also women themselves often don't feel that they're doing anything important in carrying out work within the home. Now, I think those kinds of analyses from feminism of women's role at home and outside the home in paid work are important. And I think that if we as socialists are going to present a cogent case for socialism, then we cannot disregard those differences in men and women's experience of capitalism. I think we have to deal with them, try to explain them, and most importantly, put them into some kind of a broader context of capitalist relations of production. And if we fail to do that, then I think that we leave the field open to those who do take those issues on board and who draw conclusions about what kind of political action we should be engaged in, which we would not agree with. So they can, if they're the only ones who are taking on board the fact that women are underpaid within capitalism, if they're the only ones who are taking on board the fact that women's work within the home is undervalued, then they are in a position to argue that women workers' situation could be drastically improved through such things as positive discrimination, more effective equal opportunities legislation, greater provision of creches and nurseries, and so on. And I think that if we were to be honest, then I think it's true to say that perhaps socialists have tended to be overly economistic in looking at society, that there has been a tendency to focus on the relations of production at the expense of the relations of reproduction. In other words, the way in which labour power is reproduced and maintained in capitalist society. And I think that that's an issue that we can perhaps take on board and look at how women's activity is perhaps focused on that second area of reproductive labour. To turn now to look at the question of women's sexuality and the images of women. This is one of the issues that feminists have increasingly focused on, or at least certain sections of the women's movement have focused on it, and that has become more pronounced in recent years. And I want to look particularly at the question of pornography today, because it is, in a sense, that area which is in some ways the most problematic for feminists and, I would argue, for socialists. But I think that it's an issue that is becoming increasingly important. Now, the feminist argument at its very simplest tends to go something like this, that women's depiction in everything from various kinds of advertising to hard pornography constitutes little more than presenting women as objects of male sexual desire who are constantly available, if not always willing, and that portrayal of women results in a culture in which women tend to be assessed solely in terms of their sexuality, their attractiveness to men, and not, as a consequence, taken seriously as people. At its most extreme, the argument goes that pornography leads directly to sexual violence. Now, I think that it's important that we do take those kinds of arguments on board for the following reasons. Firstly, pornography is rife, from page three girls to various kinds of hard pornography videos that seem to be increasingly available. Secondly, because sexual violence and sexual abuse is a problem that many women fear for themselves and for their children. And indeed, many women have had first-hand experience of sexual abuse and sexual violence. So it's a real problem. It's not something that's been imagined. It is a very real threat to women. Now, I'm not convinced that pornography does cause sexual violence in any direct way, but I am absolutely convinced that pornography does contribute to a culture in which sexual violence sits at one end of the continuum that includes such things as sexual harassment of women by men and a lot of other manifestations of what I consider to be a sexually unhappy society. I personally object to pornography, not only because I find it distasteful, but also, and I agree with feminists here, because I think it does degrade women. However, I would go further than most feminists and say that it degrades men as well, both those who participate in its production and those who consume it. And for me, pornography is symptomatic of a repressive sexual culture, a culture which I think makes many men afraid of their own emotions, afraid of personal contacts, afraid of genuine human relationships, the kind of things that Steve Dowsett talked about yesterday. And you can perhaps, if you take that on board, understand why some men would want to turn instead to the artificial relationship what is seen in terms of images in magazines or videos as being an easier form of sexual relationship to cope with. After all, there can be few more depersonalised, and I would argue dehumanised, relationships than that between a man and the images in a magazine or a video. Now, the question I think we need to ask as socialists is why this is so, why this is the case. And here I think we need to look much more critically at feminist arguments. We talked a bit yesterday about the kind of feminist arguments that lays everything at the door of biology. And I would reject that argument, as I think that most people here would, and would argue that it is much more to do with the kind of conditioning that we, as human beings within capitalist society, are subjected to. But I would also argue that it is also, pornography is also a manifestation not so much of sexuality as a manifestation of certain kinds of power relationships. And perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that people who are relatively powerless in the world at large then turn to the privacy of their own home as a forum in which they can exercise power over others, especially women and children, who are, of course, in general terms, even more powerless than themselves. So I think that we ought to be looking at that area of human relationships, power relationships. And I think that we also need to take on board the fact that capitalism has a tendency of turning everything into commodities, things that can be bought and sold, and sex is increasingly becoming a commodity. Now, I think that that discussion of images of women and how they can reinforce or maintain certain kinds of sexual relationship leads us on to a discussion of some of the broader issues of how and why people come to behave in the way that they do, and especially how and why men and women adopt different roles and patterns of behaviour. And here again, I think that feminism has done very useful work in looking at the way in which certain kinds of sex roles are learnt and then reinforced throughout life. For example, the ways in which young children learn different sex roles through identifying with either their mother or the father. So the little girl sees their mother doing most of the domestic work, sees their father going out to this mysterious thing called work, which they don't really have any clear conception of what is entailed there, because they don't see people working. Work is something you do outside the home. What mummy does within the home is not work. And those roles that they see and perhaps identify with are then reinforced, repeated in books, on television, in films, and so on. So therefore, the lessons once learnt are then constantly reinforced. And the stereotypic role of what it is to be a man, assertive, competitive, brave, and what it is to be a woman, timid, docile, and caring, are then internalised and become the standard against which behaviour is assessed as to whether it is normal or abnormal. Now, the important thing that we need to stress as socialists is that those sex roles are indeed learnt, that there is nothing natural about them, that we don't have to accept them. After all, we've managed as socialists to challenge another important bit of our conditioning, namely that capitalism is the best of all possible worlds, and that we should be, therefore, docile, obedient, and even grateful workers. So I think there's absolutely no reason why we shouldn't also be able to challenge and change the sex roles that we're conditioned into. Now, I said at the beginning that I thought we ought to take account of both positive lessons of feminism and negative lessons too. And staying with the area of feminist ideas, that's the sort of area that I want to look at now. Now, I think the main problem with feminist ideas is, in fact, goes right back to the starting point, and that is the way in which they tend to talk about women as if they are an undifferentiated group that all share the same interests. Now, obviously, to us as socialists, that's a totally unacceptable view, since it ignores the factor of class. Because it is not true to say that women all experience capitalism in precisely the same way. Women's lives as members of the working class are not the same as those women who are in the capitalist class. Wealth can change the experience of being a woman in very significant ways. I mean, the most obvious thing is to the extent that women are trying to combine paid work outside the home with childcare within the home, quite clearly women who have got a lot of money are in a fortunate position. They, if they can live off unearned income, don't need to work outside the home at all, they have that option, or they can simply buy in the labour of a working class woman to look after their children. Now that's a very simple example of how some of the constraints and problems that are faced by working class women are not faced by women in the capitalist class. Now, a related problem to that, of treating women as an undifferentiated group, is the danger of looking at men and women's roles and seeing the differences between them without seeing the common class interests that unite us all. So in other words, you emphasise the fact that men's experience of capitalism, working class men's experience of capitalism, is different to working women's experience of capitalism. And it's very easy to highlight those differences without recognising that there are also common links between us. And that, I would argue, leads to the politically disastrous consequence of women seeing men as the enemy, the cause of their oppression, and failing to see the ways in which working class men are also oppressed and exploited, and to see the ways in which that class oppression and sex oppression are related. And another consequence of blaming men for women's oppression is also sometimes to ascribe to them the responsibility for all the things that have happened in society that are nasty: war, aggression, pollution, competition, and so on, is quite easily laid at the door of men as another undifferentiated group. So the corresponding argument is that men are by nature all things nasty, that they have in general been dominant in society. If they've been running society, then they must take the responsibility for all the things that have gone wrong. Again, failing to see the fact that the capitalist class is not composed solely of men, that not all men have a hand in running things, so you can hardly blame working class men who are as powerless almost as working class women for all the terrible things that happen. But it's even more worrying because of this tendency to, as I said, ascribe nasty characteristics to men. This is something that came up yesterday. And I want to mention again, because I think it is important, the idea that you can ascribe to men all things nasty and you ascribe to women all things nice. So it's really rather a strange resurrection by feminists of an essentially 19th century stereotype. Then it was used primarily as an argument for keeping women confined within the home, the idea of the pure, unsullied angel of the hearth who should never dirty her hands with the corrupt, immoral affairs of state. Now it tends to be used as an argument by certain kinds of feminists as to why men should hand over to women, who are supposed to be morally superior, hand over to women the reins of power, that they will make a better job of it than men because they are morally superior beings. But incidentally, it's also used as an argument that by some so-called feminist men, and they seem to take great delight in flagellating themselves with all the problems that they have somehow been implicated in. So you probably know the kind of man I mean, the kind of man who, sitting with a group of women, will apologise before he says anything in case it's construed as interrupting women and encroaching on women's space. The kind of man who takes great delight in demonstrating his feminist credentials by being the first one to volunteer to run the creche or prove that he's really right in there with the women. I find that really quite painful to witness. You know, I get to the stage where I want to actually come out with some really quite sexist language and say, for God's sake, you wimp, pull yourself together. But there you go. And I suppose they are trying, but it is painful. Now, that raises, I think, another problem with feminist ideas. Again, it's something that was referred to yesterday, this title of biological reductionism, which basically refers to the idea that you can explain things by biology, such as the tendency for men to behave in a certain way and women to behave in certain other ways. And the argument goes that men just are naturally inclined to be that way, and women just are naturally different, as a result of their different biologies. In other words, again, we've got this idea of somehow men and women's natures being unchangeable rather than being behaviour that is learned. And that ignores all the evidence about the ways in which certain kinds of societies encourage very different kinds of behaviour in men and women. And again, Karima looked at certain societies which were organised in a different way and therefore had led on to certain different kinds of behaviour being considered acceptable or normal behaviour between men and women. Now, another area of feminist ideas which I want to briefly say something about are those connected with the idea of women's role in reproduction. And some feminists have tended to lay the blame for women's oppression on their reproductive role. So therefore, one road to liberation that is being offered to us is that of abandoning motherhood completely, embarking on this road of independence, work, career, and so on. And that is an image, another stereotype, if you like, that is being offered to women. And I think it's very interesting that, in a sense, that was the first road to liberation that many women were offered, certainly since the 60s. And many women did embark on that road. And I think it's very significant the number of women who are now reassessing whether they actually made the right decision, who are perhaps now looking to motherhood as a means of fulfilment because their role as a career person has not been all that fulfilling. And again, it comes back to something that I mentioned from the floor yesterday, which is that we cannot assume, as many feminists do, that paid work outside the home is more fulfilling than unpaid work within the home with children. And again, it's important to remember that it is not childcare as such that is intrinsically boring or uninteresting or unsatisfying. It is the situation in which it is carried out. And I think that in looking at that whole issue of motherhood or parenthood, indeed, then we can look at perhaps certain aspects of it from the point of view of socialists that enable us to go beyond what feminists are able to say. Because feminists really are only in a position of saying, well, what we need is mothers not to have such a responsibility, there to be a sharing of responsibility by putting children in nurseries. Now, that requires state provision, usually. And as we know, what can be given by the state one year can be removed by the state the next year. And we need to look perhaps at the whole issue of women's isolation and look at housing and the environment, how towns and cities are laid out, and why it is that so many women feel themselves isolated as mothers. And I think that socialists have very interesting and useful things to say about that whole area of life, what constitutes parenting, what constitutes community, what would a caring community look like. And we can also ask questions about why it is that the family has taken on this privatised form that is apparent within capitalism. We can look at the fact that within capitalism, production is primary, and all else, however important it may be to the individuals concerned, have to be fitted in round it. So that the as members of the working class, our first duty from the capitalist point of view is to produce profit. So therefore, everything else must take second place. So although reproduction and childcare is important from the capitalist point of view, it is, after all, reproduction of labour power, it still has to be fitted in round people's working hours. There's no recognition that childcare could perhaps need some flexibility to enable it to be carried out more effectively by there being a better balance between work and looking after children. Now, that's unlikely to happen within capitalism. In socialism, of course, we can offer a completely different scenario. We can look at, as was suggested yesterday, the notion of shared responsibility for children. So it isn't, children are not seen as the sole property of one or two individuals, but are seen as a shared responsibility of the community. We don't have to face that dilemma of how to balance paid work and childcare. We can adjust if we're talking about a society in which work is undertaken voluntarily, we can adjust our working hours to suit other responsibilities, other things that are important to us. So I think that we can go far beyond the rather meagre choice that feminists offer us, namely this notion of independence which leaves very little room for motherhood on the one hand, or, and again this is something else that feminists have sort of resurrected from the past, is the sort of glorification of motherhood as being the only route to female satisfaction. The other thing that I think that we need to look at in relation to reproduction that feminists have focused on is our ability to control reproduction, issues to do with contraception and abortion. Now, because I'm aware of the time, I don't want to say anything very much about contraception. I want to talk about the vastly more problematic area of abortion. Now, feminists, when they discuss abortion, well, they don't discuss it, usually. What we get presented with is a stark choice, a sort of confrontational idea of it being a question of women's rights against the rights of the unborn child. That is the that is the terms of the debate around abortion. One set of rights against another set of rights. Now, leaving aside the problematic nature of the word rights within capitalist society, I would also suggest that when the terms of the debate are presented to us in that kind of way, that it's not surprising that many feminists can be seen to be heartless, uncaring, and unfeeling, because what they're saying is, my rights as a human being are more important than the rights of this unborn child. Now, as socialists, I don't think that we have to accept those terms of the debate. I think we can perhaps ask a different set of questions, such as the reasons why some women get pregnant when perhaps they are uncertain about having a child. I think we can usefully ask questions about the relative ignorance of some, especially young women, about contraception. And we can ask questions about why it is still relatively difficult to obtain effective means of birth control. And again, especially for the young, who are perhaps the women who are most likely to have second thoughts about having a child if they find themselves pregnant. And I think we need to look at the kinds of choices that women are being forced to make in deciding whether or not to have an abortion. And again, it's that terrible dichotomy of career, personal satisfaction on the one hand, and motherhood on the other. And often the choice is between those two things because of the lack of adequate childcare. And we're given the choice between, you know, what is presented in rather glowing terms is the independence, the possibilities for personal fulfilment of the woman, and that's set against the constraints and the responsibility of motherhood. Again, there's also the argument that women are, in many cases, worried about raising their child on an insufficient income, a very real worry, I might add. And really, as socialists, I think we have to ask, why should women have to make those kinds of choices? Why should they be forced to set their own idea of what counts as personal fulfilment against that of having a child? And I think that socialism does at least begin to offer us a way out of that terrible dilemma that feminism doesn't, by firstly the removal of hypocrisy, ignorance, and the double standards that surround sex. Secondly, as I've already mentioned, by developing the idea of a shared community responsibility for children. And thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, the fact that women in socialism will not have to worry about where money is going to come from, how they're going to house or feed their children. I would argue that in that case, those women who claim to be pro-choice should very quickly consider the case for socialism, because it's only in socialism that that freedom of choice can become a reality. I want to turn away now from sort of feminist ideas and to look at some of the lessons that we can draw from feminism for our own propaganda as socialists. And I think that if we think through the implications of some of those feminist ideas that I've just mentioned, then it should in some way affect or inform our propaganda. So, for example, I would argue that it is no good talking about the working class, which is supposed to mean men and women, if in the rest of our propaganda it's made quite clear that what we're really talking about are working class men, through, for example, the concentration of emphasis on people who are in paid employment. Because many women are not in paid employment for at least a fairly long period in their lives. And for many other women, paid employment is not seen to be the main area of their life. The main area of their life is their families and their children, and they will pick up and put down paid work to suit their childcare responsibilities. And I think that we have to reflect that awareness of women's different, perhaps, perceptions of their role in society and their role in relation to work in our propaganda. That there is, it, as I said, it is not enough to talk about the working class and then talk only about paid employment. We need to take on board the large number of women who are not in paid employment and make it quite sure, make it quite clear to them that the women who are not in paid employment, who we would nevertheless regard as part of the working class, that they are made aware that we think that they are part of the working class as well. Because one of the most common objections that I find from women when I'm doing meetings is that they say that, look, you talk about the relations of production, you're talking about paid work, how does that relate to me? I'm not in that situation. Am I a part of the working class or not? We would want to say, yes, you are, of course, but we need to make it quite clear when we're talking about the working class that we don't just mean those people who are employed, who sell their labour power for a wage or a salary. We also need to make it clear that we include those women who are dependent on another worker for their means of existence. So in practical terms, I think that what that means is addressing issues in meetings and in our literature that are close to women's hearts. Now, that may be articles, meetings about childcare or about rape and sexual violence or about the issues that are broadly defined as women's issues. Now, in doing that, I think we can make it quite clear that we don't regard them as just women's issues. And secondly, I'm not suggesting that women are not interested in other areas of our propaganda. And I think that we can usefully run meetings, write articles about things like family, childcare, reproduction, and so on, and put them into the broader context of capitalist society, as they should be from the point of view of socialists. Now, the next area that I want to look at in relation to our propaganda is the rather vexed question of language. Because one of the ways in which we can make quite sure that working class women know that we are addressing them too is to actually refer to them. So I feel really that it is no longer acceptable to talk of working men when we mean working men and women, that it's no longer acceptable to say he when we mean he or she. Now, some people sort of get upset about this and sort of say that it's sort of difficult and it sounds odd and so on. But it may seem slightly a cumbersome usage at first, but you do get used to it. I thought when I first became aware of these kinds of issues that I would never get used to saying he or she. But you do, and now I must admit that I think it sounds very odd when people say he when they actually mean he or she. But I don't want to labour this question, and I think the negative lesson about language that we can draw from feminists is the ridiculous obsession that some feminists have about language, to the extent that they change perfectly good words like women, spelt W-O-M-E-N for those of you who are not familiar with the spelling, and spell it instead W-I-M-M-I-N. Now, I don't understand the reason why that they can't accept that women is a perfectly good term. Other examples are things like they've changed the word history, his story, to her story. And again, it becomes ridiculous. And the last and perhaps the most absurd that I heard recently was the word hero. Now, that is essentially the male form of the word. And there is a perfectly good female equivalent, namely heroine. But I heard somebody talk about sheroes recently, which, again, I think is just carrying the whole thing to extremes. So, you know, when I'm talking about language, that is not what I mean. It is quite specifically that you don't use the words, the word he when you mean he or he and she. The next thing that I want to look at briefly in relation to our propaganda is relates to, again, very practical issues. And that is about meetings. Because I think that we need to take on board the implications of the fact that women do have, in general, the major responsibility for childcare when we're planning our meetings, and if we are serious about wanting working class women to attend them. Because I think one of the lessons that we can learn from feminists, which they have, in a sense, had to learn the hard way, and that we knew all along, is that formal equality is not enough if the facts of people's lives effectively exclude them from acting on that formal equality that they're given by law. So, for example, it is not enough to say all women are welcome at our meetings and then hold them at times that may make it difficult for certain women to attend. So we could perhaps, and I again offer these as suggestions, as practical suggestions that we can perhaps discuss, is the need to consider the times of our meetings, the need perhaps to vary them so we don't always have meetings in the evenings, given the fact that it may be more difficult for women to get babysitters in the evenings. Many women are very frightened in certain parts of cities of walking home or catching public transport home at night. And we can perhaps think about having more meetings like this during the weekend or at lunchtimes. Again, we can vary the pattern. It's not saying that we only do meetings at lunchtimes because that would exclude other people. But we need to look at perhaps a variation in terms of meeting times. Creche facilities are an obvious point. There are many difficulties in terms of providing creche facilities, but we need to at least take that on board. Or at least consider different structures of meetings, more informal meetings, where it wouldn't matter if children were around. So that, you know, you could have a smaller discussion meeting that the presence of children wouldn't disrupt. And similarly, I think a related issue is the question of venues for meetings, the location. Where do we have our meetings? And I think we need to ask the question, are pubs, where a lot of meetings held, necessarily the best places for meetings for women to attend? Because many women are, with justification, very apprehensive still about going into pubs alone. I mean, I don't think I'm a very timid woman, but I do find having to go and meet somebody in a pub or go along to a pub when, you know, and frightened that I'm going to arrive early, and you have to sit there for a while on your own. Because the truth of the matter is, you, as a woman sitting in a pub on your own, in most towns, most areas of towns, you stick out like a sore thumb. That you can pretend to be reading the newspaper. But in fact, you know that people are eyeing you up and wondering what you're doing there alone. And, you know, the assumption tends to be, somewhere in the back of their minds, that she's there to be picked up. Now, I don't like that feeling, and I think that many women don't like it either. And if they haven't been to a branch before, then turning up to a pub where they don't know, which they may not be familiar with at all, they don't know where to go, that, you know, the meeting is upstairs and so on, can be a bit intimidating. Now, again, I'm not suggesting that we never have meetings in pubs. There's other reasons why pubs are a good place to meet. But we could, again, think about running some meetings in community centres or civic buildings that women don't have the same fears about going into alone. And again, that's just a practical suggestion that I offer. So I don't think we should ever try to construct some kind of hierarchy of oppression with white heterosexual men at the top and black homosexual women at the bottom. I think that it's an entirely pointless exercise, because while I don't want to minimise the different experiences that people have within capitalism, I think that to try to construct a hierarchy in those terms, a hierarchy of oppression, is politically dangerous, because it tends to emphasise the differences between workers more than it emphasises their common interests. Now, finally, and very briefly, I want to talk a little bit about women's role within the Socialist Party. And just as we need to take practical steps to ensure that our propaganda goes beyond a mere nod in the direction of equality, so too do I think we need to ensure that women in the Socialist Party are not only constitutionally equal, but equal in fact. Now, I actually think that that is broadly true. I think that there is no institutionalised sexism within the Socialist Party. But I still think that there are certain questions, certain issues that we can consider. Because just as from looking outside the party we can see that things like the Sex Discrimination Act, the Equal Opportunities Act, have been relatively unsuccessful in ensuring actual equality in areas like work, education and pay, and as socialists we're not surprised at that, so too I think we should not be surprised that formal equality within the party has nevertheless achieved rather less than we might have hoped for. So, for example, women are underrepresented in the party, there's no doubt about it. And although this isn't untypical, it is the case in most political organisations and in trade unions, I think that it is a particularly difficult problem to solve, since it tends to be part of a vicious circle. So, for example, women who come along to a Socialist Party meeting for the first time may find it very off-putting to discover that an overwhelming majority of the people who are there are men. They may, as a consequence, be reluctant to join, to attend further meetings, and so on. And that, in turn, will make it less likely that other women will want to join or attend meetings. Now, I think there are some things that we can do to try to remedy that. I think that we can make maximum use of women speakers wherever possible. Now, that, in turn, raises a problem, that is that there are very few women speakers in the party. And I think that we could perhaps spend some time in the discussion period thinking about ways in which we can positively encourage women to speak. And there are various things that we can do, because although I'm aware that there are many men who are timid about speaking, I think it, on balance it's less of a problem, because there are men are well represented on Socialist Party platforms and women by and large are not. And this weekend is in a sense a refreshing change. But I think that we can look at the ways in which women can be given positive encouragement to speak. We can look at the ways in which we can encourage their confidence. Because speaking in public and confidence are learned skills. You can learn how to do it better. You can learn how to overcome nerves in speaking in public. And I think that there is a strong case for perhaps looking at ways in which we could do that to encourage more women to take platform. The other thing that we can do, of course, is to, if we have got women in the party in branches, to make sure that they perhaps adopt a high profile within the branch. So, for example, if there are few women in a branch meeting, then if you have a woman chairperson, then it's very clear that women are a part of the Socialist Party and are welcome in it. So perhaps somebody else, a woman coming into the branch, would see that and be less put off. I don't know. That's, again, just a suggestion. Now, women are very active in the Socialist Party and they are frequently very busy on committees. But it does tend to be pretty much behind-the-scenes stuff. And, of course, many men do that kind of work within the Socialist Party too, and I'm not dismissing that. But I think that if we, as an organisation, are going to take sexual equality seriously, then we do have to consider very carefully how best we can encourage other women to come into the party. And it may be by using the limited resources of female members within the party rather better than we have done in the past. And we can also think about ideas such as encouraging women members to sit as delegates at annual delegate meeting and conference, which I think is a very good forum for people to try out speaking skills in public. It's home ground, if you like. And that's another thing that people might like to consider, is not just waiting for women to put themselves forward as delegates, but actually suggesting to women that they might like to sit. Again, these are just ideas. Finally, I want to look at women's role in organisations and look at the negative lessons that we can draw from feminism. Because feminist answers to organisational sexism have tended to be fairly one-dimensional. The answer is seen to be to set up a women's section or a women's committee, which has at least some kind of autonomy. Now, it's easy to see why, if women are in organisations which they feel don't take them seriously or their concerns seriously, that they might see women's sections as an answer. And I think the lesson we must draw here as socialists is that women's sections are, I think, dangerous and politically disastrous. Firstly, they effectively ghettoise women. They separate women off from the main body of whatever organisation they happen to be in. And in a sense, they reinforce the idea that there are indeed issues that are of prime concern to women and are of little concern to men. So in a trade union, something comes up about maternity pay or childcare, and it is put to one side for the Women's Committee to deal with. Now, women's sections are a product, I would argue, of institutionalised sexism, but I'm not convinced that they do anything very much to eradicate that. And I would argue very strongly for women to be an integral part of organisations of which they're in, and the Socialist Party, as the organisation being dearest to my heart, is the one where I'm most concerned that women should be right in the centre of things, not pushed out to the margins. And if that means confronting sexist attitudes head on, then so be it. Then that's what we have to do. Now, as I said before, I don't think there is institutionalised sexism within the Socialist Party, and for that reason, I don't think there has ever been a call for a women's section, and I hope we never see that. But I do think that there may be individuals within the Socialist Party whose attitudes leave a little to be desired. So, in other words, what I'm saying is that there's no need for any kind of witch hunt of sexism within the Socialist Party. I don't think that's an issue that we need to concern ourselves with. But on the other hand, I don't think there's room for complacency either. I think we do need to ensure that our structures, our propaganda, our organisation and our practice give concrete evidence to working women that the Socialist Party is a party that takes them and the issues that they care about very seriously, and that we do want them to attend our meetings and to join our party. Thanks.